Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm thrilled to have back with me today Dr. Jillian Isaac for another of our super popular keyword episodes. Today, we're going to talk about emergencies in the newborn, and we're going to divide it into two parts. But I want to say just a couple quick things up front. One, remember, we now offer CME through ACRAC, thanks to CMEify, a fantastic company that provides it for us. So if you want to get CME, just go to the website, click on the links in each episode. Now, Jillian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. So today, like Dr. Wolpaw said, we are talking about emergencies in the newborn. And I said parts one and two because there are actually eight keywords that the ABA lists. And so if I was just doing this in like a 15 to 20 minute smaller podcast, I would probably do half and then the other half. But we're going to do it all in one go. And that's why I'm calling it parts one and part two. I also want everyone to know that I'm being very brave. You probably noticed that I have steered clear of peds and cardiac until now. And we've talked enough on this program that you know that I do mostly obstetric anesthesia. So this is a little bit out of my comfort zone, and probably Dr. Wolpaw also. I haven't provided anesthetic care for a child in probably since residency 13 years ago. So it's good though. It was kind of fun to review this and go back over it. And I was surprised at how much I remember, but also how much has changed. So it's also, I think, kind of nice to see it from a perspective of someone who hasn't studied this in a while, going into it almost new de novo, and trying to figure out like what's important and what's not important. And the other thing I thought about when I was preparing for this is like, why does the ABA want me to know this, right? Like, I'm not a pediatric anesthesiologist, and a lot of us aren't going to be pediatric anesthesiologists, but my husband's in private practice and he's the only in-house anesthesiologist, and they actually have a NICU. And they do occasionally do NICU cases. And so I think there are times when you need to know at least the basics, even if you had to stumble through at least getting things going. And back when I was a resident, before Johns Hopkins opened its new buildings, all of our ORs used to be on the same level. So I remember when I was a CA3 having to start a case before the pediatric people could get in because peds was home call. And it was this neonate with necrotizing enterocolitis. And it was super challenging and I was scared out of my mind, but I had to do it, right? And so I think there are going to be times when you're going to be faced with these situations and you just really need to know the basics. But the upside of that is by knowing just a few key things on each of these topics, you can answer almost everything correctly on both the written and oral exams. They don't expect you to be an expert in any of these, but just knowing a few really high yield things is going to help you a ton on this test.
Awesome. You agree? All right. I agree. Okay. So, yeah, and I'm with you 100%. It's been a long time with peds, but you know, there are things that, that are important to know. And again, whether we like it or not, a lot of this stuff is obviously going to be on the test. So folks out there who are looking at taking their, board exams coming up, this is important stuff to know.
Yeah. And this is on the basic, not on the basic. This is advanced. And it's, if you're going to look at the ABA content outline, it's on page 37. It's under pediatric anesthesia, subsection H, and it's entitled emergencies in the newborn. And they have eight keywords in this category. Okay. So there's diaphragmatic hernia, there's tracheoesophageal fistula and esophageal atresia. Neonatal lobar emphysema, pyloric stenosis, necrotizing enterocolitis, omphalocele gastroschisis, respiratory distress syndrome, and then myelomeningocele. All right. So if we go back, I'm going to go through each one by one, and I'll talk about what has been tested historically and what I think will probably be on the test in the future and going forward. So we'll just go one by one. So the first one is the diaphragmatic hernia. And interestingly, this hasn't been tested since 2012. And I think because a lot has changed actually in the past decade in how we manage these patients. And so there are historically kind of questions that were asked that they've taken out because they're no longer correct. And I'm bringing that up because if you're using data banks like me that are a little bit older question banks, it's not necessarily accurate anymore. So it's important to know kind of what was testing, but the changes that they've made. So I have a few key points here that I want to go through, and then some questions, like kind of outdated questions, so you know that they're outdated, and then questions that I expect to see going forward. So that's based. So the ventilatory strategies have changed over the last 10 years. So if you're using older question banks, like I said, they may be wrong. So that's important to know, right? So a congenital diaphragmatic hernia, it's an early development defect that results in intra-abdominal organs going into the thoracic cavity. And the defect can be isolated or it can be associated with multiple congenital anomalies, and cardiac anomalies are the most common. And that's actually really important as we go through these, is a lot of these, not all of them, but a lot of them actually can be part of a syndrome, and they want you to know what's associated with these things. 90% of CDH are located in the posterior lateral diaphragm, and almost all are left-sided. Physiologic consequences of CDH include lung hypoplasia, pulmonary hypertension, and pulmonary arterial or dysregulation and reactivity. So historically, CDH was actually considered a surgical emergency, and it was approached using very aggressive hyperventilatory strategies. But what we've found in the last 10 years is that these are actually very harmful to the lungs of neonates. And then also when they looked at survivors of CDH, that they had kind of chronic iatrogenic lung disease. So we've realized that what we were doing in the past is wrong. So now ventilatory strategies employ small tidal volumes with permissive hypercapnia, and then also preservation of spontaneous ventilation. And now we actually wait to intervene until the support from the ventilator has been minimized. So it used to be a true emergency, now not so much. We're not doing aggressive hyperventilation anymore. And so I think going forward, that's probably what we'll start seeing on these tests is this more spontaneous ventilation, wait until you've minimized ventilatory support. The other thing with these, and I do OB, is now they actually help treat these by putting in a fetoscopic endoluminal tracheal occlusion balloon, and it helps with the development of the lung. So we're actually treating these in utero, which is really cool. And I could see that going forward, asking them questions about these fetal procedures. But so I want to give you an example of an old question. So you know when you're reading these that this is outdated. So totally outdated. But if you're looking at old ACE questions or old IT questions, this is what you're going to see, and it's wrong. Okay. So you have a newborn in respiratory distress. Exam shows a scaphoid abdomen, cyanosis while breathing oxygen by mask, and heart sounds in the right hemithorax. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step? A, assisted ventilation with a bag and face mask. B, insertion of a chest tube on the left side. C, insertion of an NG tube. D, tracheal intubation and assisted ventilation. E, tracheal intubation and expansion of the left lung.
Right. And as you said, maybe at one time it would have been D, tracheal intubation and assisted ventilation, but now not necessarily. And so I'm sure that's why you're saying it's outdated. And obviously, you would not want to stick a chest tube in the left side, certainly at least not blindly, where you may end up in the intestines that are up there if this is a CDH. So you want to think about that. In terms of expanding the left lung, you're not going to be able to expand it when the intestines are what's causing it to collapse. Right.
There, so, right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But the stem is very classic in terms of a stem for CDH. So the scaphoid abdomen, cyanosis, heart sounds in the right hemithorax, right? And back in the day, they didn't necessarily diagnose this always on ultrasound. Now we know going into it, but that's a very classic, like, clinical signs of a CDH, okay? So Right. Now going forward, these are questions that you may see, all right? So this is a 3.3 kilogram neonate is brought to the OR for repair of a left diaphragmatic hernia. A 3 millimeter endotracheal tube is placed to a depth of 9 centimeters. Initial ABG values from a right radial catheter while spontaneously breathing oxygen 50% are PaO2 82, PaCO2 41, pH 7.33, and a base excess of -5. After reduction of the hernia, so during closure of the abdomen, vigorous attempts to expand the atelectatic take two lung are unsuccessful. The infant rapidly becomes very dusky, heart rate is 60, breath sounds are distant and squeaky bilaterally, and pulmonary compliance is decreased. Which of the following should be done first? A, obtain a chest x-ray of the chest. B, place a chest tube on the left. C, place a chest tube on the right. D, withdraw the endotracheal tube 1 centimeter in suction. E, reopen the abdomen.
Yeah, so I think this is a tough one. Anytime you're in the chest, dealing with things in the chest, you want to think about the fact that you may have a pneumothorax or even a tension pneumothorax. I'm reaching back here, but I think there is risk in these situations because you're really aggressively trying to inflate that left lung. So you're applying a lot of pressure. You can blow out the right lung and then end up with a tension pneumothorax on the right. So that's something you want to have in mind. Yeah. So you would certainly
and
listen.
The right lung is also not really fully developed. So even all the abdominal contents are on the left. So you definitely don't have a developed left lung. The right lung isn't awesome. It hasn't developed properly. Yeah.
Right. So you would certainly want to do what you would always do, take a listen. But if you didn't hear breath sounds on the right, that would be a pretty good indication that this had happened. And then you'd want to either needle or place a chest tube on the right side. So I'd go with C in this question.
Yeah. And then this is just a test taking strategy. This is actually really funny. I have a book of logic puzzles sitting right here on my table. I love logic puzzles. And to me, standardized tests, like you have to have knowledge, but there is like a systematic way they're written. And it is a bit of a logic puzzle. And a lot of times if you see things that are opposite, so like B is placed a chest tube on the left and C is placed a chest tube on the right. Even if you didn't know anything about this, it usually comes down to those two answers. And then you could think, well, most of these hernias happen on the left side, right? So you don't want to put, like you said before, a chest tube into the left and put it right into like an intestine or a liver or something. So if you're going to put a chest tube in, it makes more sense to be on the right. And this is a tension pneumothorax. And unfortunately, like severe CDH, despite intensive treatments, it actually still has a very high morbidity and mortality. But once again, we used to go right to the OR with these and now they're more stabilized. So even though it's a neonatal emergency, it's not like you have to go to the OR like right now. Okay. Another question, CDH. A premature male neonate born at 34 weeks of gestation is scheduled to undergo emergency repair of a left-sided diaphragmatic hernia. Which of the following vessels could be cannulated for preductal arterial blood sampling? A, femoral artery, B, umbilical artery, C, right radial artery, D, left radial artery.
And so this would be the same if you were talking about just trying to get the most proximal blood that's coming out of the heart. So it's first going to go to the right subclavian and so to the right arm. And so you want to do the right radial artery. And that first branch off the aorta is going to come off before the ductus arteriosus. So that's why you want to do that.
Yeah, the right. And again, remember we talked about opposites, right versus left. This is one of the things that this question comes up again and again, not just in this scenario, like the preductal. It's something I've just memorized. It's a good thing to know. Yeah. Okay, so last question when it comes to CDH. Appropriate management of a neonate born with CDH should include A, insertion of an orogastric tube, B, expansion of the hypoplastic lung with positive pressure ventilation, C, hyperventilation to keep the PaCO2 below 40, D, rapid transport to the OR for surgical correction.
Yeah, and this is, as you said, maybe a ways back, the answer here would have been D when they would have treated this as a surgical emergency that needed to be repaired right away, but not anymore.
And C. Right? We used to have this very aggressive hyperventilate, intubate, and not C anymore. Yeah.
Right. So that lets you get rid of C and D by knowing that those are kind of the old answers. And then, you know, you definitely don't want to be super aggressive trying to expand a hypoplastic lung because it's not going to work. And then you might blow out the other lung. So you want to insert an orogastric tube here if for no other reason than by process of elimination. But obviously, if that stomach is up in the chest, it's only going to help you to decompress it.
Right. And just for me, so I finished residency 12 years ago. And for me, it's just amazing how much progress we've made in that decade and how much change in the way we treat these kids, in the in utero treatment. So it's actually really kind of cool to see the progression because it's not often you see this much change in a decade in medicine. So I thought that was actually kind of fun for me to see that.
Absolutely.
Okay, so moving on to our next keyword, which is tracheoesophageal fistula and esophageal atresia. So historically, what they've tested is where you want to put that endotracheal tube, especially when you have like a fistula, the connection between the esophagus and the trachea. And then what other abnormalities is this associated with, like in terms of like syndromes, okay? So just key points here. So the first one is that I'm going to say TEF and EA, just to make it easier for tracheoesophageal fistula and esophageal atresia. So a TEF is a congenital defect. It's thought to be the result of a foregut malformation. Don't really know why it happens. It's associated with EA. The malformation can be present in various formations and they're categorized A through E. I remember this being on my test. Like they showed me pictures and I had to pick out which one was which, right? So type A is the isolated EA. About 8% of all EA, TEF babies just have the esophageal atresia. So it's like a blind pouch and then the distal portion of the esophagus. 90% of these are type C. So a type C, it's a fistula between the trachea and the lower esophageal segment in conjunction with the upper esophageal atresia. So you have esophagus, which is kind of like a blind pouch. And then you have your trachea coming down. And then you have the second part of the esophagus that doesn't connect to the top part. And that connects to the trachea. So due to the connection between the trachea and the gastric tract, it's the intubation and mechanical ventilation during surgical intervention that's probably the most challenging part for an anesthesiologist. The next key point is that one of the foremost concerns is the avoidance of ventilation through the fistula with resultant gastric distension and then inadequate pulmonary ventilation. A hallmark in the airway management of these patients, just like CDH, is to try to maintain spontaneous ventilation until the fistula tract is ligated. Not always 100% possible in the OR, but that's really what you're trying to do, okay? The next key point is that TEFs are very commonly associated with the syndrome Vater and Vactorl. Is that how you say it? V-A-C-T-E-R-L. It's Vater. So Vater is vertebral anomalies, anal atresia, tracheoesophageal fistula, esophageal atresia, and then renal kidney or anomalies. And then if you're adding on the Vactorl, it's cardiac and then limb. And that's a really, really common question. I've seen that out a lot in the past few years about that syndrome. Okay.
Yeah, they'll ask like what else is likely to be associated with.
Exactly, yep. Right. So about 35% have cardiac disease with a TEF EA, and it can be VSD, ASD, tetralogy flow. It can be any of those. And TEF repair, it's urgent, and it may be emergent if the respiratory insufficiency is so severe that you require ventilatory support. But it's, again, it's not like you have to go to the OR the minute the kiddo was born. Okay. So here's some questions about a TEF CA. So a 2.2 kilogram, 6 hour old neonate is to undergo gastrostomy followed by a repair of a tracheoesophageal fistula. During induction with sevoflurane air and oxygen, the abdomen becomes distended. Appropriate management is to A, intubate and assist spontaneous ventilation, B, intubate and control ventilation, C, insert an orogastric tube, D, allow the patient to breathe spontaneously by mask until gastrostomy, E, control ventilation by mask until gastrostomy.
So we're assuming here that they are being undergoing an inhaled induction, and that means they're breathing on their own, and you're seeing the abdomen become distended. So presumably what's happening here is that the air they're breathing in is going preferentially into the, or at least some of it is going into the GI tract, and so you need to stop that. But the only way to do that is going to be to intubate them and place that tube past that fistula. And so you're going to want to intubate them. And then the question is whether to do controlled or assisted. And as you said earlier, Jillian, you really want to do assisted spontaneous ventilation if you can. And so you would intubate. This is choice A. You would intubate, assist their spontaneous ventilation, and hopefully that'll take care of it. If you had to, you could control their ventilation, but ideally you would allow them to breathe spontaneously.
Yeah. And if they're not telling you what type of fistula it is, you should just assume that it's the most common one, which is C. And that's the one where you don't want to put an OG tube in because you just have this like blind pouch proximal esophagus, right? And then you have the distal part of the esophagus that connects to the trachea. So you want to intubate and try to get the tube past that, like you said, past the fistula. So if they're not telling you exactly what type, you should just assume that. Okay. And that comes to our next question. So I put this in here and I know you can't see pictures, but I know on my board exam, I actually had pictures, and you should really look them up and just draw out A through E or A through F a couple of times. Because once you go through the order of it, it actually makes a lot of sense. It's not that hard to remember them. And I really encourage you to, because it's a really common question that you'll see out there. So I wrote it this way. Obviously, you can't see the picture, and I'm going to give you descriptions, but it says, which figure of the esophageal atresia or tracheoesophageal fistula is the most common? So A is type A. And so type A is pictured, which is an esophageal atresia without a fistula. So just basically a broken esophagus. E, which is a tracheoesophageal fistula without an EA, is also called type H, which is confusing. Then there's type C, which is esophageal atresia with a distal tracheoesophageal fistula. And then there's type D, which is an esophageal atresia with a proximal and a distal tracheoesophageal fistula.
Right. And as you said, the most common is type C. So C will be the answer here.
Yeah. But they're not always going to do that. They're not always going to line up like answer choice A is a type A, answer choice B is a type A. They will mix it up. So you need to actually know what it looks like.
Right.
And again, type C, it accounts for almost 90% of all cases. So it's hands down the most common one. And if you just are going to learn one of those, learn that one.
Yep.
So next question, the most common initial symptom of EA and TEF is A, respiratory distress at delivery, B, projectile vomiting, C, hypoxia, D, regurgitation during feeding.
And so most of these, remember, including the most common one, has that blind pouch of an esophagus. And so you're going to see regurgitation during feeding because it's got nowhere to go.
Exactly. Next question. So which of the following is the least appropriate technique for induction of general anesthesia in a newborn for surgical repair of TEF? A, awake tracheal awake tracheal intubation, B, inhalational induction with spontaneous ventilation and tracheal intubation, C, inhalational induction using positive pressure bag and mask ventilation and tracheal intubation, D, rapid sequence IV induction and tracheal intubation. And again, least appropriate.
Right. And so you know, the one thing you don't want to do here is use positive pressure through their natural airway, their mouth and nose, because it's going to go through that fistula. So the rest of them all involve being intubated, which allows you to direct the air the way where you want it to go. C is the one that is just bagging and using positive pressure. So that's the one you want to avoid because it's going to inflate the GI tract.
Yeah, exactly. And of the keywords that we've done thus far, I think this one is probably the highest yield, tracheoesophageal fistula and the esophageal atresia. Common questions.
Yeah, comes up a lot.
So the next one is neonatal lobar emphysema. I couldn't find a whole lot on this. The last I saw that it was tested was actually in 2012. I do OB anesthesia, so I see all these like babies being born, and I haven't actually seen this in a really long time. So just a couple key points here. Congenital lobar emphysema is a disorder of lung parenchyma that results in hyperinflation of the lung and respiratory distress in infants from newborn to 6 months of age. And then the next key point is that the primary concern with anesthesia is managing the airway in an infant with pre-existing respiratory compromise without making the respiratory distress worse. Anesthesia can be induced with volatile or IV agents. And the classic teaching is to use inhalational agents and maintain spontaneous ventilation. See like a theme here? positive pressure ventilation may cause more respiratory compromise, so more harm than good. So here's a question that I found. An infant with congenital lobar emphysema is scheduled for thoracotomy. Which of the following should be included in the anesthetic management of this infant? A, helium oxygen inspired gas mixture. B, nitrous oxide administration. C, positive pressure ventilation. D, prophylactic placement of a chest tube. E, spontaneously ventilation until the chest is open.
And as you said, you want to try if you can to maintain spontaneous ventilation. So E would be the answer here.
Right. And I can't think of a single time where you put in a prophylactic chest tube, can you?
No, I think, yeah. I mean, I'm sure there are times, but it seems like that would be an extreme.
Yeah. And the other question that I've seen, I couldn't find one, but I know that I've seen them out there, is if it was asking something differently, which of the following is totally avoided? Nitrous is actually contraindicated in these surgeries because it can rapidly diffuse in a closed cavity, leading to further compression and immediate mediastinal shift. So it's just kind of something to tuck in there and know. I don't think that neonatal lobar emphysema is a super high yield topic, but again, it's one of the keywords. So I just wanted to quickly go through it in case, you know, you hear my voice in the back of your head when you're taking the test and you can get one more question correct. Okay, moving on. The next one is pyloric stenosis. And I think this is also one of the higher yield topics. I actually remember a question on my written board. It was about the electrolyte abnormalities of this. And that's what you're going to see. You're going to see like fluid therapy, electrolyte disorders, metabolic abnormalities. That's probably the more common questions. I don't know if you remember from your days of studying pyloric stenosis.
Oh yeah, this comes up a lot. Absolutely.
Yeah. So pyloric stenosis, it is a medical emergency, but it's not a surgical emergency. And that's important to know. You do not want to operate until there's been adequate fluid and electrolyte resuscitation. And the next one is the cardinal findings in pyloric stenosis is dehydration, metabolic alkalosis, hypochloremia, and hypokalemia. So the loss of gastric fluids leads to volume depletion and loss of sodium, chloride, acid, and potassium. And that's why you get a hypokalemic metabolic alkalosis. And I couldn't find a question, but I know that they asked that over and over. Okay. So a couple of questions to practice pyloric stenosis. Infants with untreated pyloric stenosis are at increased risk for each of the following except A, congenital heart disease, B, dehydration, C, hypokalemia, D, increased gastric acidity, E, metabolic alkalosis.
Yeah. And so you went through these: dehydration for sure, hypokalemia for sure, metabolic alkalosis for sure. Interestingly, increased gastric acidity is a little tricky because you're losing H plus, right? You're losing acid. And so you might think it'd be less. And the answer is it's a congenital heart disease. They're not at increased risk for that. So the answer is A. I'm guessing it's not increased gastric acidity. That's not the answer because there must be some, the fact that they're losing so much hydrogen ions must put their kind of production in overdrive, I guess. I don't know if you have thoughts on that, Julie.
At increased risk for, so they're not at increased risk for increased gastric acidity, right? Because it's untreated or at increased risk for each of the following except.
Right. So they are at risk for all of the, So that would mean they are at risk for increased gastric acidity.
Right. So, yeah. Yes, exactly. Right.
Yeah. But I'm just not 100% sure why.
I think because you're losing it from the pyloric stenosis that your stomach is just like making
churning it out. Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Next one. So I hate those accepts. And it's good that we had that little back and forth there, because from what I've been told, they're doing away with these.
Yes. Yeah. You should not see any more of the following accept on tests. Yeah.
So a 5-week-old male infant is brought to the emergency room with projectile vomiting. At the time of admission, the patient is lethargic with a respiratory rate of 16 breaths per minute and has had no urine output in the preceding 3 hours. A diagnosis of pyloric stenosis is made, and the infant is brought to the OR for a pyloromyotomy. I hope I said that right.
Sounds good to me.
The most appropriate anesthetic management would be A, awake intubation after placing an oral gastric tube, B, inhalational induction with sevoflurane with cryo pressure, C, awake saphenous IV catheter or an IO needle placement, followed by a rapid sequence induction with ketamine, atropine, and rocuronium, or D, postpone surgery.
So this is a little bit of a trick question because, as you said up front, this is not a surgical emergency. This infant is clearly not medically stabilized. They're lethargic. They haven't been making urine, so they're clearly dehydrated, et cetera. So this is not the appropriate time to take this infant to surgery. They need to be stabilized from a medical standpoint, and then they can have surgery. So the answer should be D, postpone surgery.
Right. So again, it's a medical, not surgical emergency. And I could see this asking this on a written test, especially the electrolyte abnormalities, but I could also see this being an oral board stem, and they want to see that you're not going to get pushed around by a surgeon, that you like, nope, not appropriate management. This is not a surgical emergency. And then they'll say, after you have stabilized the infant and all electrolytes and fluid management's okay, then we're going to proceed. And that's how this stem would proceed. So I could see it going both ways. Okay. So the next keyword we have is necrotizing enterocolitis. And again, in this whole list of keywords, I think this is probably on the lower yield side, but you still see it from time to time. So the key point is that necrotizing enterocolitis is the most common gastrointestinal emergency in neonatal intensive care units, making it one of the leading causes of long-term disability in preterm infants. It's more common in preterm infants associated with low birth weight, so a birth rate less than 1,500 grams, so really the kind of micropreemies. And the next key point is that the most common presentation of NEC is intolerance to enteral feeding, abdominal tenderness and distension, bloody diarrhea, lethargy. And you can tell that by reduced spontaneous motor activity, respiratory distress, shock, and body temperature instability. And really the pathophysiology of NEC is just generally poorly understood, but it can be a true surgical emergency. So here's a question that I found about NEC. So this is a 1,150 gram, 10-day-old infant undergoing a bowel resection for necrotizing enterocolitis. Heart rate is 200 and blood pressure measured through a femoral artery catheter is 45 over 24. What is the most appropriate next step? Administration of A, calcium gluconate, B, epinephrine, C, esmolol, D, fentanyl, E, normal saline solution.
Yeah, well, obviously, if we saw those vitals in an adult, we would call a code. And I'm guessing, though I could absolutely be wrong, that they're not that abnormal for a preemie. I don't know. You probably know better than I do.
So heart rate like should be like around 120, 140. So 200 is high, but not like code high. And then a blood pressure like 60 over 30 is better. Like, so
this
45
is low.
Over 24 is low. Yeah.
So knowing that, sounds like this infant probably could use some fluid. And so probably E is going to be the answer here.
Yeah. So this is like sepsis, right? It's very common. And this is how they present. And I was telling you back when I was a CA3 in the old buildings having to start this case, we didn't have a peds attending. I didn't have a peds fellow. It was me and I shouldn't say names, but I will. It was me and Alan Gottschalk. And it was terrifying, this poor little baby. And so if you ever find yourself in this situation, I actually went and got the NICU fellow, and they were so extraordinarily helpful because I just didn't have much experience with this type of patient. This poor baby was just so, so, so sick. And basically it was a lot of fluid management because they are just really septic.
All right. Hang in there. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks. Pattern is a disability insurance company, and they know that you want to be confident and in control of your finances. In order to do that, you need to buy disability insurance. Pattern understands the problem is that researching insurance is complicated and time-consuming, which can make you feel overwhelmed and unsure of who to trust. Pattern knows that your time is valuable, and they believe that doctors have more important things to do than worry about insurance. That's why thousands of doctors have trusted Pattern to help them understand the insurance they're buying. Here's how they do it. You go in, you request your quotes, you compare your options, and you buy risk-free. So request your quotes today at patternlife.com. That's PATTERNLIFE.com. So you can stop wasting time and feeling overwhelmed and instead save money and spend time on the things you love, being confident your family and income are protected.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, and we're back with the next question with Dr. Isaac.
So here's the next question. Necrotizing enterocolitis has all of the following characteristics except: A, most have thrombocytopenia and a prolonged PT and activated and a PTT, so coagulative havoc. B, commonly associated with decreased cardiac output in the presence of fetal asphyxia or postnatal respiratory complications. C, umbilical artery catheters are useful to assess acid-base status. D, occurs in 10 to 20% of newborns weighing less than 1,500 grams. So which... it's an except again. So basically it's true, false, right? So you're trying to find the one that's false.
Right. So, you know, this is, I think, quite a difficult question actually. And yes, you may or may not know these things. D is kind of an easy one because you did talk about that. It tends to happen in really, really small infants. So that you can say is true. So that means it's not the answer because it's, this is all the following except.
And unfortunately, it's quite common in these like less than 25 weekers.
Yeah. Right. Most have thrombocytopenia and a prolonged PT, an APTT. That seems reasonable. They're bleeding. Right. Yeah, they're bleeding. They're not doing well. Commonly associated with decreased cardiac output in the presence of fetal asphyxia or postnatal respiratory complications. Again, that seems probably reasonable in these micro preemies. And so you're left with the umbilical.
The idea there is like the gut is probably not being adequately perfused. Like something happened where you weren't perfusing and that led to the hit.
Right. And so then you're left with the umbilical artery catheters. And I think there's something about if you're already having bleeding and ischemia in the gut, you don't want that blood flow compromised. So you don't want to have an umbilical artery catheter in there.
Yeah. So I did look this up because I wasn't 100% sure on the answer. And so what I found is that they can be very useful in newborns, but they should be removed if NEC develops because they can actually compromise mesenteric blood flow. And then interestingly enough, an umbilical artery cannulation is actually a risk factor for developing NEC. And it's not clear if it's causal. It might be like these are just really sick babies and that's why they have it. And that's why they get NEC versus does the catheter itself cause it? But you don't want one in a baby with NEC is the bottom line.
Okay. Great.
So the next two words we're going to do, I'm going to do them separately, but in the outline, they're mixed together and it's gastroschisis and omphalocele. And of all the keywords that we're doing today, I would say this is in the top three of like the high yield. I would say for the ones today, it's the tracheoesophageal fistula, pyloric stenosis, the omphalocele gastroschisis, and then maybe CDH. But this is probably up there in the more common and higher yield than some of the other keywords that we're looking at today. So just some key points here. So the way they've tested gastroschisis commonly is pulmonary complications of gastroschisis and then abdominal closure and complications with abdominal closure. And that's probably what they're still like commonly testing today. So just a key point here is that gastroschisis, it's a periumbilical defect. It's resulting from the occlusion of the omphalomesenteric artery. And the big contrast to an omphalocele is that in gastroschisis, the visceral contents are not covered by peritoneum. It's like a really bad hernia where your intestines and sometimes other organs are like sticking out there, but it's not covered at all by peritoneum. Neonates with gastroschisis, they're a high risk for inflammation of the exposed viscera, as you could guess, edema, and then a dilated and foreshortened gut. So a few questions here. A 2,600 gram neonate is to undergo surgical repair of a small gastroschisis. The infant is pre-oxygenated with 100% oxygen. Arterial hemoglobin desaturation is noted during laryngoscopy after a rapid sequence induction. Which of the following is the most likely cause? A, high fetal hemoglobin concentration. B, high ratio of oxygen consumption to functional residual capacity. C, low functional residual capacity in milliliters per kilogram. D, poor thoracic compliance. E, patent ductus arteriosus.
So as you said, these patients have this, their gut essentially exposed. It can often be inflamed. It can be edematous. And so I'm going to say here probably they're going to be utilizing more oxygen than normal. And also, of course, little newborns are going to have a relatively low FRC. It's why they, even healthy ones, desat very quickly. And so if you're using a lot of oxygen, you just don't have a big FRC, you're going to be at risk for desaturation. So I think B, high ratio of oxygen consumption to functional residual capacity, is probably the right answer here. It is, you might think, well, why not C, low functional residual capacity in mLs per kilo? And that is because by weight, it's not that it's low, right? By weight, it's just that they don't weigh anything. So overall, they have a small FRC. So that's how I'd go there.
And I think even if this wasn't this is a small gastroschisis, I think it was just asking, why do neonates desat quickly? It's a pretty good explanation as to why they do.
Right. Okay. Right. And that may be the case, actually. It may be that there's nothing unique about the gastroschisis. I was hypothesizing that maybe the inflamed gut was using more oxygen, but maybe not. Maybe they're just getting at the fact that small newborns are going to desat quickly no matter what.
Yeah. And they tend to have fine lungs. Their lungs are fine. They have good compliance. So next question. A newborn infant is undergoing repair of gastroschisis. During closure of the abdominal wall, ventilatory pressures and central venous pressure are increased markedly. The most appropriate management is to A, administer a bronchodilator, B, decrease tidal volume and increase ventilatory rate, C, increase the neuromuscular block, D, increase the depth of anesthesia, E, ask the surgeon to reopen the abdomen.
Yeah. So what this sounds like to me is that they've developed compartment syndrome. And now this does get at abdominal compartment syndrome. So this does get at what you were saying earlier, inflamed, edematous bowel is now being shoved back into the abdomen. Yeah. And then that abdomen's being closed. This is true of, an adult patient with an open abdomen who then gets closed, right? You have to really be careful because that pressure in the abdomen can lead to abdominal compartment syndrome. And that's what's going on here. So you'd want to ask the surgeon to reopen the abdomen here.
And I found a very similar question in a different resource, which just goes to show you how commonly this question is asked. If you see the same question asked in multiple places, you're going to most likely see it on the test. But it's an infant becomes cyanotic and hypotensive after ventilatory pressures increase to 45 centimeters of water during closure of the abdominal wall at the end of a gastroschisis repair. The most appropriate next step is to A, administer a muscle relaxant, B, administer 5% dextrose in LR solution, 10 milliliters per kilogram, C, change the endotracheal tube, D, ask the surgeon to insert a chest tube, E, ask the surgeon to reopen the abdomen.
Yeah, so same thing. And, certainly giving a lot of fluid is only going to make this worse and cause more edema, so you wouldn't want to do that. But yeah, asking the surgeon to reopen the abdomen makes sense here.
Yeah. And the lungs are fine, right? So the likelihood of a tension pneumothorax is really low. If this was like a CDH, I'd be thinking much more along those lines. But there's nothing about a gastroschisis that inhibits development of the lungs. So you shouldn't really be so worried about that.
And my memory is that a gastroschisis, even though it sounds worse because it's just the bowel's just out there, it's not actually covered by anything, actually has a better prognosis. It's not usually associated with other abnormalities, whereas an omphalocele... Omphalocele, which seems better because everything's still contained by the peritoneum, but actually is associated with a lot more problems.
Exactly. Gastroschisis is more like a bad hernia, right?
Yeah.
It can be associated with other things, but typically no. Whereas an omphalocele is very highly associated with other congenital defects and syndromes.
Right.
Which gets us to omphalocele. So they actually test that. They do test its association with heart disease and other associated conditions. So that was actually tested in 2020. So that's a question that is circulating out there, as well as the heart disease. And then they like to compare and contrast omphaloceles to gastroschisis. And that was tested in 2016 and 2018. So the key point here is that an omphalocele is a failure of gut migration from the yolk sac to the abdomen. So in contrast to gastroschisis, patients with omphaloceles have peritoneum covering their otherwise exposed viscera, but about 40 up to 60% of patients with omphaloceles will also have other congenital anomalies. So most commonly a congenital heart disease and actually bladder extrophy. So those are the two ones that are commonly seen with omphalocele. So here's some questions about omphaloceles. So a 2.8 kilogram, 8 hour old infant undergoes laparotomy for a ruptured, omphalocele. Following primary closure of the abdominal wall, Arterial blood gases are a PaO2 of 40 with an FiO2 of 0.6, a PaCO2 of 55, and a pH of 7.1. Blood pressure is 30 over 20. After increasing the FiO2, the most appropriate action would be to A, obtain a chest x-ray immediately, B, withdraw the endotracheal tube 1 centimeter, C, assess the patient for coexisting congenital heart disease, D, administer LR 15 milliliters per kilogram, E, ask the surgeon to reopen the wound.
So, you know, again, this is an abdomen that has had a lot of trauma. It has been, you had a ruptured omphalocele. Certainly, you're going to have a variety of a lot of swelling, et cetera. And again, the abdomen was closed primarily, as it says in the stem. And so you've got to think again about, could this be a problem with pressure in the abdomen with that kind of low blood pressure, worrying about venous return? So I think, again, asking the surgeon to reopen the wound is what makes sense.
So the next one is, in calculating the fluid requirements for a newborn undergoing repair of an omphalocele, the third space loss should be replaced by A, 0.9% saline solution, B, 2.5% dextrose in 0.45% saline solution, C, 5% dextrose in LR, D, 5% dextrose in water, E, 5% dextrose in 0.25% saline solution.
Well, which of these things is not like the other, right? So four of the five have dextrose. I am not going to pretend to understand why specifically you wouldn't give dextrose here, but I think it's probably the answer. Probably is going to be normal saline because the other ones are all various forms of dextrose. So I would probably go with the normal saline.
Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong, and since you do critical care, but with dextrose, it's basically just water, right? Once you break down the sugar, so doesn't that make third spacing worse?
Yeah, or so that's a good point. So it as going in, D5W, for example, is going to be relatively isotonic, but the dextrose will then be metabolized and you'll be left with water. So that may be here is saying you would just end up with more third space fluid.
Right. That was my thought.
Yeah.
Again, we're not pediatricians. But
definitely not.
All right, next question. So a 2.8 kilogram newborn undergoes repair of a moderate size omphalocele. IV fluid is administered at 14 milliliter per hour. 45 minutes after beginning surgery and before reduction of the omphalocele, arterial blood pressure decreases from 80 over 40 to 55 over 30. SaO2 is 98% at an FiO2 of 0.5. Breast sounds are equal bilaterally. Which of the following is the most likely explanation for the decrease in blood pressure? A, associated congenital cardiac defect. B, compression of the lungs by the abdominal contents. C, inadequate fluid administration. D, pneumothorax. E, sepsis.
Yeah, so, you know, I'd have to actually go back and try to calculate whether that's appropriate fluid administration. 14 mLs per hour seems like really a small amount, but this is also a small infant. They may well have an associated congenital cardiac defect, although there's no reason to think that all of a sudden 45 minutes into surgery and before any reduction of omphalocele that has all of a sudden acted up. So that seems unlikely. Compression of the lungs by the abdominal contents. Again, they're not up in the chest, they're out of the body. So that doesn't make sense. Right. Yeah. And pneumothorax again, it could be the case, but there's not necessarily any reason to think that. And this is more commonly.
They're telling you the breast sounds equal bilaterally.
They tell you that. So that more or less rules it out. Again, no particular reason to think all of a sudden this infant is septic. So most likely inadequate fluid administration. And I think if we think back, right, isn't the rule 10 mLs per kilo for the first, up to the first some number of kilos, but this infant should be on almost 30 mLs per hour, not 14. Now I could be wrong about that. So please don't everybody write in and tell me that that's incorrect, but I'm pretty sure that 14 for that size infant is not enough. And so I would probably go with C, inadequate fluid.
So with the omphalocele, and I don't know if you've ever seen it, but when the baby is born and with gastroschisis, they have like a bag that they put over to keep in like the heat and moisture. And once that comes off, like when you're in the OR, this is basically like an open belly. So there is a lot of fluid shift.
And a lot of insensible loss.
Yeah, exactly. But you're not really likely to get sepsis, like, because it's covered with peritoneum, but there is quite a bit of insensible loss here. So yeah. I think that's what they're getting at. And key is that equal breast sounds bilaterally, and it's before closure.
Right.
Actually,
so now it's coming back to me. We don't actually use, this has been kind of debunked in adults. It's the 4-2-1 rule, right? So 4 mLs per kilo would be 8, and then, another kind of 12. So that's probably actually using the 4-2-1 rule, that may be appropriate, that 14 mLs per hour. So I think you're right. Probably what they're getting at is that you can't just do traditional maintenance fluid right. when you have an emphyseal because they have all these insensible losses.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So the last one for emphyseal, this is a 4-kilogram, 3-hour old newborn with macrosomia and large fontanelles, is scheduled for surgical repair of an emphyseal. Physical exam reveals macroglossia, but no other anomalies. Which of the following is likely to occur in this patient? A, hyperkalemia, B, metabolic acidosis, C, hypoxemia, D, hypoglycemia. And this is a tough one because you've got to figure out what syndrome is, what's going on.
And I certainly do not know what syndrome this is. So I probably wouldn't be able to get this question right. But without knowing the answer, you'd have to, as you said, identify the macrosomia, the large fontanelles, the emphyseal, and put that together.
Macroglossia.
Yeah, it's right. So why don't you tell us what the syndrome is?
It's a Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome. And it's very commonly associated with emphyseals. And like we said, emphyseals actually have a lot of syndromes that they can be associated with and a lot of cardiac issues. So Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome, just to remind you, because I had to look it up, is characterized by an emphyseal, organomegaly, macrosomia, large fontanelles, and macroglossia. You can also see polycythemia and hypoglycemia. So I think I said the answer is hypoglycemia, but they also want you to know that they can be difficult to intubate because of the macroglossia. Okay, so last question here. Congenital syndromes frequently associated with cardiac abnormalities include all of the following except A is a TEF, B is a meningomyelocele, C is emphyseal, and D is gastroschisis.
Yeah. And so like we said before, gastroschisis actually is not usually associated with other abnormalities. So that's going to be the answer. The rest definitely can be associated with cardiac abnormalities.
I mean, gastroschisis can be, but it's much
less likely.
Like less frequent. Exactly. Right. Much less likely. Yeah. So the next one is RDS, respiratory distress syndrome. Interestingly enough, this hasn't been tested since 2008. I don't think it's a super high yield one, but just to go through it, respiratory distress syndrome is caused by a deficiency of surfactant. So it's basically a kiddo that hasn't had enough time in gestation to produce enough surfactant before delivery. And so when you don't have surfactant, it's just difficult to generate inspiratory pressure needed to inflate alveoli. So you get progressive atelectasis. And so you get, once you have that diffuse atelectasis, you get the high resistance, low compliance, and then hypoxemia from the VQ mismatch. So a couple of questions that I found. One, and they're usually regarding surfactant or like surface tension, but the most beneficial effect of continuous positive airway pressure in a newborn with respiratory distress syndrome is A, increased functional residual capacity, B, decreased airway resistance, C, promotion of surfactant formation, D, increased alveolar PO2, E, maintenance of functional closure of the foramen ovale.
Right. And so, when you have RDS, as you said, lacking surfactant, you're going to have collapse because surfactant is what keeps the alveoli open. So you're going to have really quite reduced functional residual capacity. So by using CPAP, you can help open some of those alveoli up and increase your FRC. So A would be the answer here.
Okay. And the last question that I could find about RDS is, which of the following statements concerning relationships among alveolar pressure, volume, and surface tension is true? A, surface tension of surfactant decreases as alveolar volume decreases. B, surface tensions of water and of surfactant behave similarly as volume decreases. C, changes in alveolar surface tension with volume are the same during expansion as during contraction. D, pressure in the alveolus is inversely related to surface tension.
Yeah, I'm reaching back here. I think surface tension of surfactant decreases as alveolar volume decreases. I think that's right.
Yeah, so water and surfactant actually behave very differently. Water has has a lot more ionic interactions than surfactant, so they actually behave quite differently. And then pressure in the alveolus is actually not in, what's the opposite of inversely? related to
directly surgery. Related.
Fortunately, there you go. Yeah. Okay. So the last keyword is myelomeningocele. And again, like in dividing these half and half, half high yield and half not high yield, I think this is in the higher yield end of these eight keywords here. So meningomyelocele, they test what associated anomalies can be with myelomeningocele and then its association with Arnold Chiari. Those are the ones that come up. Again, in the past 10, 12 years, we've made huge strides in how we've treated this. We always used to wait until the baby was born. And this is actually still considered a fairly true emergency, surgical emergency, because you don't want to get meningitis. But now we're doing a lot of in utero meningomyelocele repairs, where you actually go in to the uterus and close these deficits weeks before the baby's born. And it's shown that it actually helps inflammation of the brain, helps prevent the Arnold Chiari malformation. So just some key points. Myelomeningocele results from an abnormality in fusion of the neural tube during the first month of gestation. And the failure of the neural tube closure can result in a sac-like herniation of the meninges. So that's a meningocele, or a herniation of neuroelements along with the meninges, which is a myelomeningocele. Myelomeningoceles, they're most commonly found in the lumbosacral area, but they can result at any level. And you can get loss of motor and sensory function below that level of lesion. And that can include bladder, bowel, and sexual function. Repair of myelomeningocele is a surgical emergency, and neonates should be operated on in the first few days after birth. And then the next key point is that nearly all infants with the myelomeningocele have supraspinal neurological manifestations of the disease process. And it's almost always like an Arnold Chiari 2 malformation, and they can get obstructions, and almost all of them need VP shunts. So those are the more common questions. So the questions that I found regarding myelomeningocele, the first one here is: a four-year-old child with a myelomeningocele and a VP shunt is scheduled for bladder augmentation. 1 year ago, hypotension and bronchospasm occurred during laparotomy for placement of a feeding gastrostomy and responded to fluids and epinephrine. At that time, anesthesia was induced with propofol. The trachea was intubated with a polyvinyl tracheal tube following administration of succinylcholine, and anesthesia was maintained with sevoflurane and nitrous oxide. No diagnostic tests were performed after that incident. Which of the following should be avoided during the bladder augmentation? A, latex gloves. B, polyvinyl tracheal tubes. C, sevoflurane. D, succinylcholine. E, propofol.
Yeah, you know, am I reaching back here? But I think that I remember these being associated with latex allergy. So I think probably that bronchospasm, and certainly even if all you think is, well, hypotension and bronchospasm, that sure sounds like anaphylaxis. If you think, well, which of these things is really prone, we know, to causing anaphylaxis, latex is a big one. So I would probably go with latex gloves here.
And this is not necessarily unique to kids that have myelomeningocele. It's any kid that's had multiple surgeries with exposure to latex. So like bladder extrophy kids is another example. That's the other one that just comes to mind.
Gotcha. Right, so maybe that's it. I may have been remembering incorrectly about there being an association. So maybe you're right. Maybe it's just that they have repeat surgeries.
36 hours after primary repair of a meningomyelocele, a term newborn has frequent periods of apnea lasting 25 seconds and associated with an oxygen desaturation to 80%. The most likely explanation is A, hyperglycemia, B, loss of cerebrospinal fluid, D, residual anesthetic effect, C, obstructive hydrocephalus, and then E, normal postoperative events.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, these patients are very commonly have some block in their ventricles and can therefore have obstructive hydrocephalus. When we're talking here about frequent periods of apnea, it sounds like probably central apnea. So obstructive hydrocephalus is probably your most likely go-to here.
And then the last question of the day here is: a delay in surgery for 24 to 48 hours for preoperative stabilization and preparation is acceptable in each of the following neonatal conditions except A, biliary atresia, B, diaphragmatic hernia, C, meningomyelocele, D, pyloric stenosis, E, tracheoesophageal fistula.
So we already talked about how pyloric stenosis and tracheoesophageal fistula are not necessarily surgical emergencies that need to go directly to the OR. Biliary atresia and diaphragmatic hernia. We also talked about diaphragmatic hernia. Biliary atresia we didn't talk about, but that also is I believe, not an immediate surgical emergency. Meningomyelocele certainly can be or is, and so that would be the one that you don't want to delay.
Right. So in the list, emergencies in the newborn, most of these are medical emergencies, very few surgical emergencies, myelomeningocele being the one that you really can't delay because you risk meningitis. But again, just to kind of summarize in these keywords for emergencies in the newborn, if you're going to see questions, my guess is going to be about a CDH, a tracheoesophageal fistula, pyloric stenosis, or omphalocele gastroschisis. Those are probably the higher yield ones.
Fantastic. Jillian, this has been great. Another really high yield keyword episode. Let's turn to our random recommendation portion of the episode. Do you have a random recommendation to recommend to the audience?
Oh, sure. So I'm currently reading the biography of Eleanor by David McCallis. It's about Eleanor Roosevelt. Fascinating. I didn't really know much about her, but she was really like a, you know, the woman behind the man.
Yeah. Who's the author?
David McCallis, it's like Michael with the IS at the end.
Nice.
It's called Eleanor. Right. It's actually here. Yeah.
Yeah. She was just, I mean, I haven't read that book, but the books I've read that have included information about her, she just sounds like such a fascinating, incredible woman. So that's really a great recommendation. Since I have you on, I'm going to recommend a book that you recommended to me called Hamnet. It's a book by Maggie O'Farrell, and you had recommended it. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I think you recommended it on this show. So
I did.
I will, I guess, make a re-recommend it because you, thanks to you, I went back and read it. It's really good. It's about, as I'm sure you described last time, it's about, it's a novel. But it is about, presumably about Shakespeare. I think he did lose his son, right?
He had a daughter and then twins, and he lost his son
right
in the plague. Mm-hmm.
So that's true that he lost his son, but the book is kind of hypothesizing maybe, you know, some of the interpersonal interactions that would have happened between him and his wife and their family and how this would have affected them. And it's really beautifully written and really
brilliant writing, right? Yeah, brilliant writing, really creative story. Yeah.
Yeah. So I will second that recommendation. All right, Jillian, thanks so much. We'll have you back on the show soon.
All right. Sounds great.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrac Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Dr. Brian Park is our tech lead. Ryan Okonski is our social media manager. And Dr. April Liu is our production assistant. Thank you so much for all that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.